everybody, and good morning. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can catch us on restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Good morning, Mark.
Good morning, Francis. How are you today?
I'm well. How are you this morning?
I'm doing well. I find it ironic that, you know, Francis and I always have a few little things in our bag of tricks, things that we want to talk to you guys about on a given day when we're doing these shows. And today we both had a Burger King presentation for you today.
And this is not an advertisement for Burger King.
Well, a few weeks back, and Francis knows this because I told him about it the day I did it, that on a day we were going to do a show, I stopped into a Burger King because I was going to bring Francis the Burger King jalapeno and cheddar BK Steakhouse burger because I was going to bring it to him.
I heard about that thing, I heard about that, and I left the state today.
But anyway, I was going to bring you one so we could try it together because I know you don't watch a ton of TV, and these commercials had been out, and they had been everywhere earlier in the year. Mm. They had been out, and they had been everywhere. It was one of those things in the back of my brain that every time I saw this commercial, I thought, that is the worst-looking food I've ever seen in my life.
You know, I know that we're really far out of the mainstream because more and more I watch commercials, and they're like, look at the food, and like the pictures of the food, and I think, that's disgusting.
I see a lot of the chain restaurants and fast food restaurants showing you food, and I'm like, oh, I'd be so embarrassed. I would be so embarrassed to take a picture of that.
Right.
And I understand that the food when you go to a fast food chain isn't going to look like the picture on the wall. But, oh, my God, what if it does?
But, no, this is a particularly abominable, and you have brought me, Mark, a lovely picture, though I never did get to try the burger.
I did bring you a picture, and Francis, you can describe the picture if you'd
like. Oh, I don't think I can because Burger King will sue me.
I would think that most of you have seen the advertisements, and it just looks like
they put pieces of cheese.
Looks like your dog had a bad day.
They put pieces of cheese inside the burger, so when
cheese and jalapenos.
But the cheese is disturbing, Mark, because you can't put cheese inside a burger unless you do really unnatural things.
It's really...
It's got to be a cheese that will hold together inside a burger when you're cooking it and it doesn't melt into the burger. How frightening is that? Whatever your burger is made of.
Okay. So the part I didn't tell you about the story is...
Yeah?
I went into a Burger King to order this sandwich thing, Burger King's jalapeno cheddar stuffed steakhouse.
Thank God no one saw you or the radio show's canceled.
I went in and I said, I would like one of these jalapeno... And they looked at me like I was from another planet.
I guess they're not going over that well. Is in the particular
Basically,
Burger King you were in?
They looked at me and with their eyes they said,
"Really?
You don't really want one of those, do you?" And I was like, "I do. I want one." And they were like, "We don't sell those anymore."
Really?
That's at least the Burger King I went to.
That's great.
They got kiboshed because they were hideous. Okay. I printed this out in color so Francis could see how awful.
Yeah, it's scary looking. And color copies cost us 5 cents more. So, and Mark's pretty cheap, so you know that he
totally
really cares.
Worth it. Totally worth it.
All right. Well, I have my own Burger King thing that I brought to you.
Yes.
Which, and this is totally by accident. It is in a Nation's Restaurant News reports favorably, by the way. So don't take my tone as the tone of Nation's Restaurant News about a brilliant, and I put that in air quotes because you can't see it because I'm on the radio, a brilliant marketing campaign.
Francis, here's what I'm going to say to you. It is a brilliant marketing campaign. Maybe the bad day burger for picture that was not a brilliant marketing campaign, but this is a brilliant marketing campaign.
Okay, I don't watch a lot of TV, so I haven't seen a lot of what's going on with various marketing things. But this is in the trade publication, Nation's Restaurant News. Miami-based Burger King is offering a coupon for free Whopper to any person who watches DirecTV Channel 111, where footage of the chain's signature sandwich is playing on an endless loop through Friday.
Well, this is a couple weeks.
This is a while back. It's hard to argue that someone staring at the television for 5 minutes is working very hard toward a tangible goal. But in the case of Burger King's Whopper Lust promotion.
What a great name.
It lasts, this is the Crispin Porter Agency is their agency. What they're doing is the last little advertising campaign they're doing with them. So I think this was Crispin Porter's bid to hang on. You have to stare at the screen. And to prove that you're giving the rotating Whopper your undivided attention, viewers must press a series of buttons when prompted by the screen. And staring at the sandwich for 5 minutes earns a free Whopper coupon. But people can keep going and win two Whoppers if you stare uninterrupted at the screen, or three sandwiches if you stare at your television for 30 minutes.
No, no. Stare at the Whopper on the screen of your television for 30 minutes.
And you're no looking away. No looking away.
Or you'll miss your little instructions.
Does this scare the hell out of anybody but me?
Well, I don't know. It depends.
And if you chant, I love the Whopper, I love the Whopper, and it's
no,
brainwashing.
It's much better than that. You're the little rat pressing the bar for a Fruit Loop.
Little rat.
Okay, yeah, that's what you are. I remember I did these psychology studies when I was in college. You're the rat who presses the bar, and if you press enough times, a little Fruit Loop will come out for
and
you.
And if you go to their offices and let yourself be hypnotized, they'll give you four Whoppers. I don't know how anyone doesn't find this disturbing, but check this out. The video has been viewed a total of 406,000 times as of the Wednesday in the promotion it was offered.
All right. There's a lot of unemployment out there, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So look here. You're not looking at this the right way.
Yeah.
Okay. So I can win three Whopper coupons in 30 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
Whopper costs, what, $3-4?
Yeah.
Okay.
No, I don't think so. I think it's less than that.
Okay. So let's call it $3.
Okay.
All right. So I can get three Whoppers in 30 minutes.
Yeah.
That's $9. That's basically an $18 an hour job you got working right there.
You got to sell them, though. You got to sell your coupons. Do you find this as disturbing as I do?
Oh, it's awful. I compared it to the rat in the cage pressing the bar for a Fruit Loop.
This is really above and beyond. I mean, we've talked about different kinds of advertising. Maybe right, maybe wrong. But this is really crazy above and beyond. All right, it goes on more. I didn't realize that all this other crazy stuff was happening here. Benjamin, who is this? The guy Benjamin from Burger King. He says that Crispin Porter and Burger King structured the offer to make it a branding opportunity, not just a giveaway. A mind control opportunity, not just a giveaway. There were some other promotions where they did whether you could just like something on Facebook and get a free product, but this was a better value exchange. He said, we'd rather have our consumers spending 5 minutes staring at the Whopper than just clicking like or sending their name and address. Yeah, I'll bet you would.
I know. I actually just figured out what Crispin Porter's alias is. He's the Riddler.
They had run a program. Ready for this, Mark? They had run a program in the past called the Whopper Sacrifice, where fans could get a free Whopper coupon if you ended your Facebook friendship with 10 people. What? And if you smacked your mom, what'd you get?
Here, kick the dog. Two Whoppers.
Oh, what the hell?
Double quarter pounder with cheese.
Are you serious?
If you beat the neighbor boy.
Oh, my. If you stole money from your mother, well, all you got was the money you stole from your mother. But there it is. Okay, other campaigns for the signature sandwich have included the Whopper Freakout. I saw this one on TV, in which the chain pretended to no longer sell the Whoppers and recorded the customers' tirades when they told them. And they're like, no, we don't sell that anymore. And then they watched their customers freak out.
Oh, is this like a hidden camera thing, or was it a fake thing?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And they'd be like, no, I'm sorry, we don't sell that anymore. And they record the tirades. All I have to say to that is, ha, ha, ha. That's funny. Yeah, that's really twisted. What the hell's wrong with you? It's really, really twisted marketing.
We are going the wrong way.
Yeah, well, maybe they shouldn't sell. I don't know. That's just this is the most bizarre thing I've read.
We're going the wrong way.
This is the most bizarre thing I've read. All right, hey, listen, we got a great guest coming up in a couple of minutes. Stick with us. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys on and RestaurantGuysRadio.com. Hey there, everybody. Welcome back. It's Mark and Francis, the Restaurant Guys. And our guest today is John Mariani. He is Esquire Magazine's food and travel correspondent, and his new book, is How Italian Food Conquered the World.
John, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Didn't Italian food wasn't it always in control of the world?
No, maybe America about 10 years ago, but it's taken a little longer to conquer the rest of the world.
John, this book really goes into the history of, you know, the Italian food and the Italian-American food. I don't know if you know, but obviously I'm Italian-American, and we own a restaurant called Catherine Lombardi, which is based off the, you know, kind of the food that my grandmother had in the house on Sunday afternoons from you know, as long as I can remember, to probably 30 years before that. So from the 30s and 40s to, or even before that to till she passed away. And we call our restaurant an Italian-American restaurant because we always felt it was a, and really what we call it is a Brooklyn Italian restaurant, because we always felt it was a misnomer to call it, having been to Italy, to call it an Italian restaurant, because there really aren't any restaurants like that in Italy, are there?
No, and I think you're being very both candid and honest about an authentic Italian-American cuisine, which is, in fact, largely different from what you're going to find in most regions of Italy. The difference between the two is, as I said, the region, so that the food of Lombardia and the food of Liguria don't resemble each other very much at all. And then as you move south, the cooking that they do in Florence and Tuscany has very little to do with the food in Naples and Sardinia and Sicily and Campania. So as you alluded to, your grandmother, as did my grandmother, I am sure that she probably came from southern Italy. And I'm sure she was not a wealthy restaurateur or chef over there. And that the basis of the Italian-American experience was one of women just like her who, back in the old country, their sole reason for being was to have children and to feed those children at just a subsistence level because there was nothing to waste. And when they got here, what those same women found with their husbands and families is that they had been spending 75% of their meager income back in the old country. Here they're only spending 25% of their income.
On food.
So the Italian woman, the Italian immigrant woman in America, quite literally became empowered to become the best cook on her block, the one whose meatballs were renowned in the neighborhood, whose Sunday red sauce, tomato sauce, was better than anybody else's, and to take pride in being able to fatten up your kids and your husband and to show the abundance of the American way of life. That's what Italian-American food is all about.
And grandchildren.
Mark being the grandchild, yeah. Well, now, it's funny, you talk in your book, I mean, it's illustrative and it's really great, where you begin your book talking about how you can't really talk of an Italian food until before there was even an Italy, which is a relatively recent development. And yet we talk about these food traditions in the various regions of Italy that weren't even it wasn't even a country yet, that are cited in Roman times. But when people talk, what people need to realize is that in old historical books, when people are referring to Italy, they're referring to the Italian peninsula in the same way you might refer to Asia. You know, that it's not a single country with a single culture and certainly not a single food culture.
Not at all. It was, as I alluded to before, Ligurian food was different from Sardinian food and so forth. But you also had these myriad influences because everybody conquered or tried to conquer Italy at one time or another, from the Phoenicians to the Visigoths, from the Ostrogoths to the Moors, from the Moors to the Spanish and the Austrians and the French. So everybody added a little bit to it, but there was no such thing as Italian food until the unification of Italy took place in 1861. And when you talk about ancient cookbooks and ancient Roman texts, those were written exclusively for slave cooks for the noble houses. So their recipes bore almost nothing, no resemblance to what the most people were eating, most of whom did not have much to eat, and those who did, maybe lived in the cities and were merchants, ate further higher on the hog. But to identify anything as Italian food until 150 years ago was just almost bogus.
So what are today some things that have, for the in recent history, bound Italian food together? Are there characteristics that you can say legitimately are Italian food?
Yeah, there are at this point, and I would say as of the early 20th century, one could certainly identify certain characteristics. They would be that pasta was foremost, which would range from macaroni to polenta to risotto, not all of which was served in every region of Italy by a long shot. You could say that in the south, the tomato and tomato sauces really did predominate, as they did in Italian-American food, and that as after World War II, as Italians became more of had more wealth, and there was a strong middle class, that's when you start to see more meat of what was literally growing on the hillside, so that you have this famous abbacchio ham of Rome, which is a tender baby lamb they serve at Easter, which has been feeding on the mint leaves in the Roman hills. So these have kind of coalesced into an Italian food, but it's still very, very distinctly regional over there. I was there just a month ago, and I was in Turin and Venice, and the two regions are 3 hours apart by train, but they couldn't be more different.
Mm-hmm. And that's exactly true. I mean, every place that we've been to in Italy, Francis and I, together and separately, you don't have to go very far to have a completely different food culture in Italy.
Yeah, it's quite the adventure.
It's kind of like saying New York versus Pittsburgh in food culture. You know, it's not that far. They're not that far apart, but culturally, the foods that they're eating are pretty different.
Very much so. Just as and even farther apart would be the food of the South and the mm-hmm. food of New England, or the food of New England and the food of the Southwest. Except for the fact that at this point you can walk into any supermarket in Phoenix, Arizona, and find
lamb
frozen
chops.
Manicotti, sure. Lamb chops, or whatever. And the big shift, as I say in my book, was that back in the late 1970s and early 1980s, American cooks, Italian cooks in the United States, who were kind of badgered as to why their food didn't taste as good as it did in the old country. It was a simple ingredient. It was the ingredients, and they couldn't obtain them at any price. So when they started to bring in extra virgin olive oil, true prosciutto, which had not been allowed into the United States by the FDA before that to protect the domestic ham industry, basically, and you started to get great Italian wines that hadn't existed even 10 years before that, and true Parmigiano cheese, which was not imported before then. All of these things made it possible for Italian chefs of this country, or anybody who wanted to cook Italian food, as at your place, to approximate the flavors and the genuine goodness and wholesomeness of true Italian cooking.
So what has changed in the last 15 years? I mean, you've written the book now, and how has Italian food conquered the world, and how do you mean that? How do you view Italian food as having conquered the world?
Have you seen Mario Batali's birth certificate?
Yeah, exactly.
Silvio Berlusconi, Mario Batali is a plant, and Silvio Berlusconi has been planning this for 20 years.
Uh-huh.
And Mario Batali in the 1990s was a signal figure. Joking, of course, but he was a signal figure in the 1990s who built upon basically three things that came before him. I alluded to the improvement in ingredients and the wish among American foodies to be as authentic as possible, to be as rigorously authentic as possible in cooking anything, Chinese food, German food, Mexican food. They try to get the best. So that was in place by the 80s. What also happened was that Italian food became very stylish as the fashion world shifted monumentally and very quickly from Paris and French fashion to the fashion of the Italians, the Ferragamos, the Missonis, Dolce Gabbana, Armani. These were the darlings of the 1980s and continue to be so. And this was all played out in fashion shows in Milan, where the fashion directors of the big houses and the designers would have lunch at a little Tuscan bistro in Milan. Milan is not in Tuscany, but they seem to play out in Tuscan bistros for some reason. And that the buyer from Bloomingdale's would be sitting with Gianni Versace on Wednesday at this trattoria, and all the models would go to a place called Paper Moon for these thin pizzas. This became reported on in all the media. This was, you started to see the cover of Vogue with Italian models or being on a Vespa on the Via Veneto in Rome. It was all created to give Italian food a very chic new image. And these restaurants of that stripe I just mentioned started opening in the late 80s, places like Dice, places like Harry Cipriani, places like La Madre, many others, which really were insisting that they were going to be serving the authentic regional food. And then very important also in the 1990s, when the Mediterranean diet idea came in. That concept allowed people who previously had dismissed Italian food as being too heavy, full of garlic, full of cheese, too much sauce, too much food. The Mediterranean diet showed, you know what? Italians aren't fat, and they eat pasta every single day. Italians aren't fat, and they use olive oil, and they don't have heart disease. Well, this just clinched the deal. So when Mario Batali came along, he was this big, ebullient figure. So he was probably just the best spokesman for Italian food, having been born himself in Seattle, Washington, that could possibly happen.
Well, you know, I think that's a pretty interesting recap of how we got to where we are today. But one of the things that I found most interesting about your book was how Italian food came into being in America, in from Italian immigrants to being in restaurants and pizzas and to processed food as well. But we're gonna take a quick break. We'll come back on the other side and we'll talk about the history of Italian food in America. Our guest is John Mariani. His book is How Italian Food Conquered the World. And we'll be back in just a moment on WCTCAM and RestaurantGuysRadio.com. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Mark and Francis, the Restaurant Guys. We're talking with John Mariani about his book, How Italian Food Conquered the World.
John, when I was a kid, and certainly even more so when my mother was a kid, an Italian person, an Italian-American person would never have considered eating out in an Italian restaurant just because that was kind of the food that you had every day or certainly every Sunday. How did those restaurants gain traction without the Italian-Americans in them?
Well, I think what you say is largely true of a lot of Italian-Americans. In my particular family, my parents used to like to go out to eat, and they would go to a steakhouse, they would go to a continental restaurant, and they would also go to Mamma Leone's if they wanted to. So it was really just a night out, and we used to go to a terrific, terrific Italian restaurant in the Bronx called Amerigo's, which is no longer there, which started out as a pizzeria back in the 1930s. And as it's interesting that as these guys who owned these pizzerias started to serve more food and they got a better clientele, they shut down the pizza oven as being low class. Funny thing is that today, no Italian restaurant would dare open without a pizza oven in it, even a fancy place. But to get back to your question, was that the Italian food of, let's say, for lack of a better word, the Little Italies around America, and they're everywhere. They're in Cincinnati, they're in Cleveland, they're in St. Louis. This was very lovable food that people went to, non-Italians went to, because it was very lovable, and it was very cheap, and it was very abundant. And they loved the flavors. What's not to like about tomatoes and cheese and a little bit of garlic and a great pizza on a Friday night? So that consequently, the connection between Italian-Americans and just plain Americans was very tight even before World War II. After World War II, what happened was that, as I detail in the book, the Italian movies, La Dolce Vita most specifically, and movies like that, that showed a new breed of post-war Italians being very glamorous, and also American movies made in Italy, which was very, very cheap to do. So you had Audrey Hepburn on eating gelato on the Spanish Steps with Gregory Peck. You had Rosanna Brazzi in about 10 movies seducing everybody from Catherine Hepburn to just about everybody in the Hollywood pantheon. Olivia de Havilland, Rosanna was always after them. And this was a new Italy that people had never seen before, because they had always thought of Italy as that wonderful scene in Walt Disney's animated feature, Lady and the Tramp, of the big roly-poly Tony and his cook playing the violin with a red checkered tablecloth, Chianti bottle with straw, and eating spaghetti and meatballs. This was a lovely image, but it was also a corollary image to which I know you probably share, the Italian-Americans find despicable, was the linking of all Italian restaurants with mobsters and mafia.
Yeah.
And this has been persistent. The Sopranos was the worst example of that, which, I mean, I remember there was one, I didn't watch very many of them, there was one episode in which like 15, 20 of them have a big meal in an Italian restaurant, and they go outside into the alley, and the waiter says, well, you know, you didn't tip very much, and they shoot the guy.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah,
this
that's
is,
right.
This is horrible.
I've thought about doing that sometimes when people don't tip enough, but I've never had the guts
well,
to follow through.
Well, bad service, maybe, but, yeah.
Yeah.
So those are the two strains. You had the roly-poly lady and the tramp strain, and the Chef Boyardee type of image. And then you had this other image was, am I going to get shot if I go to, you know, Umberto's Clam Bar or Spark Steakhouse because somebody got shot there 40 years ago?
And you talk about in your book that you feel that was really, that inhibited some of the general population from going to Italian restaurants, because even though they were serving really good food, it wasn't accorded the same respect as, say, a French restaurant would be accorded. You know, it was the cheap, you know, it was a cheap restaurant kind of an idea.
Well, so was every other ethnic food. Italian was no different. You just were not supposed to charge anywhere close to what you could charge in a French restaurant for. I mean, if you take a piece of veal in a French restaurant, you treat it to just lemon butter, they can charge anything they want. They can charge $30 for it. You take a vitello alla limone, a scallopini, and you try to serve the same exact dish in an Italian restaurant, and you have to cut the price by half.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I remember when it was, I know that it was Del Posto, and then there was somebody before that who was really going for the first to be the first three-star Alto. It was Alto. And they were shooting to be the first three-star Italian restaurant in New York City. And I think we've matured to the point now where we understand that, you know, you can have great – the high food of any culture is, you know, it's about the cost of how you're doing it. And there's no reason we should look down on Italian food as not being as refined.
Well,
as
those restaurants, though, aren't really – those aren't Italian-American restaurants.
No,
those
Italian,
are Italian restaurants trying, you know, featuring either regional cuisine or several different regions.
Well, let's go back a couple of – a generation or so and go into the – you know, you talk about the idea of Italian cuisine being slightly exotic but not too exotic.
Mm-hmm.
And you also write in your book about – frozen pizzas and jarred sauces, and there is a lot of foods that are Italian that lent themselves in America anyway.
We'll call them Italian-esque.
Italian-esque. Yeah. To being processed or canned or popular. I mean, we jar our own tomatoes for our own sauce. That's a processed food. I mean, we do our own tomatoes locally, but you know, you had a rise of very wealthy, very large revenue generating. I mean, home tomato sauce, ragu tomato sauce, generated a lot of money to a lot of people. And you talk about how Chef Boyardee actually wound up changing the spelling of his name.
Yeah, it was originally spelled B O I A R D, Boyardee, but for Americans to pronounce B O I A R D with that kind of elision over the I and the A was tough, so he changed it to B O Y, which every American boy, and then R D became Chef Boyardee. And he's a remarkable figure because he started out and he made a fortune selling canned spaghetti. And Italians had always been very, very, very instrumental in the canning industry, going back to Contadina tomato paste coming out of California and so forth. What Chef Boyardee, or Chef Boyardee did, was he was selling canned spaghetti to the military during World War II and made a great deal of money. And these guys preferred to spam, I assume, because when they came home from the war, they made him a multimillionaire by keep buying this spaghetti in a can, which was very, very cheap and very, very delicious to them. And really caught the spirit. Americans have also been responsible, Italian-Americans, for creating this pizza oven, which is created by an Italian-American who made ovens in New Rochelle. And he came back from the war. He told his family about these pizzas, and they said, well, coal-burning, wood-burning, that's not going to work. So they invented the pizza oven. Frozen pizzas came along very quickly after frozen bird's-eye peas and all the frozen foods of the early 1950s. A pizza was a natural thing to try and a good snack food. So then, you know, Stouffer's came along and put fettuccine Alfredo into the supermarket. It was much more popular than any other ethnic food, even though the supermarket shelves now are lined with as many Mexican products as they are with Italian, I would think. But that says a lot about the demographic shift of the Latinos in this country.
Well, and I also think it's funny because if you're going to preserve some sort of food, like you can actually preserve a tomato sauce better than you can preserve other foods. It's not, you know, it's not the same as if you're making it fresh from the best ingredients. But I just want to, we're going to have to leave it right here, but it is interesting how now in fine restaurants and even in okay restaurants, you are seeing the return of the wood-fired clay pizza oven.
People are going back to the traditional pizza ovens. Well, I think that whole period, you saw a lot of people. It was trendy to take those shortcuts, to have those shortcuts. Don't spend so much time in the kitchen. Don't spend so much time on food. And now all of a sudden, you see people reemerging from that malaise and saying, you know, I can spend more time making something better than the Chef Boyardee can of SpaghettiOs. Actually, not SpaghettiOs. Sorry, different brand. I'm sure there's some kind of...
Uh-oh, Mark, you made a mistake with that one. But like
don't forget Rice-A-Roni.
The San Francisco treat. We shan't.
That's right.
Anyway, John, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Great pleasure, you guys. Best of luck.
Thank you very much.
John's book is How Italian Food Conquered the World. You can find out more about it on restaurantguysradio.com, and we'll be back in just a moment.
Hi, this is Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants and also of the Restaurant Guys Radio Show. You know, one of the best things about the restaurant business is the creative side of it. Coming up with big ideas and then turning those concepts into reality is awesome. It's what I love most about what I do. But it can't stop there. If you can't communicate exactly what it is you're doing, then you'll find yourself standing alone in your dining room, just you and your big ideas. The Mardini Group can help you get your ideas across to others. The Mardini Group is a boutique graphic design firm, and they do extraordinary work. We use them, and as you know, we only use the best. Whether it's menu design, product packaging, a corporate report, promo material, a homepage, or an awesome logo for a brand new project like Catherine Lombardi, we turn to the Mardini Group. Some small business owners don't realize how important it is to have a strong visual identity. Without it, you come across as less than professional. That can cost you trust, and that lowers your bottom line. First impressions count for a lot, and that's why you need the Mardini Group. Go to restaurantguysradio.com and click on the Mardini Group link, or call them at 718-694-9944. The Mardini Group for graphic design, 718-694-9944.
Hey there, everybody. Welcome back to Mark and Francis, the Restaurant Guys. Chef Boyardee, you know, and we didn't really get all the way into that. Okay, Chef Boyardee, I get it now. I knew he was a real guy, and it started out as Army rations.
Well,
and it still tastes like Army rations.
Here's the beauty here, and John mentioned this during the interview. Your choice was Spam Chef Boyardee.
Exactly. It's a tough one.
And so Chef Boyardee became very popular.
Yeah, I would choose Chef Boyardee
outside
over,
of Hawaii. You know, if the Hawaiians still
and the Philippines, the big Spam in the Philippines. Big in the Philippines.
I don't get that.
We're big in Japan. My band is big in Japan.
I don't get that.
So, but here's the deal. First of all, anytime I open canned stuff like that, I really am not crazy about it. But especially to me, because I don't see it very often. You mentioned SpaghettiOs. I'm not crazy about that. Opening the can of it, just I don't enjoy the smell at all. And the worst is when there's canned meat. If there's like canned spaghetti and meatballs, I don't know. Last year I was in someone's kitchen and they were cooking a can of some kind of spaghetti and meatballs.
It's those little ravioli, the little meat stuff, and it's stuffed with meat.
Yeah, the canned meat
stuffed ravioli. There's nothing that smells as bad as that to me. Like, and I'm sorry if I'm sounding foodist. But I can't take it. People put it in the microwave.
There's a similar smell to dog food. I'm sorry.
There's
but there
a
is.
Similar smell to dog food.
And maybe that means the dog food's really good. I don't know. But whatever it is, I don't want to eat it. You know, I'm not a dog. I think if you have canned food all the time, you have canned meat all the time. Maybe you don't smell that anymore. Mm-hmm. But I don't. And but what I love about Chef Boyardee is he took the name B-O-I. A-R-D-I? Boyardee?
That was awful.
B-O-I-A-R-D-I. It was exactly right. Boyardee. Chef Boyardee, right?
Yeah, not only I don't know. I believe you just for the sake of argument.
Not only did they change his name to Chef Boyardee, B-O-Y-A-R-D-E, but just to make sure you got it right, it's B-O-Y-A-R-D-E-E.
Right.
I've always wondered, what is that
You don't
from?
Want to say Boyard.
Right, or Boyardee, Boyarda. It's funny when you think
Chef
about a time
Boyardee.
when America was so parochial that that was, you know, create like a Boyardee would be a
that
crazy
was an
name.
Important marketing decision. That was a really, really big marketing
wouldn't have
decision.
It. Wouldn't
it,
have made it.
It may not have made it otherwise. They just those types of foods in how we live now, and I understand why they became popular. Like I said, you had women starting to go back to work. You had families that were trying to conserve time.
And you had the advent of modern marketing convincing you that to be modern and good,
right,
you had to have the TV dinner.
What I don't understand is how those products still remain on the shelves. When you can, frankly, go and buy a box of pasta for $1 and buy a jar of tomato sauce for $2, why anybody would ever buy a can of Chef Boyardee?
Cooked up pasta already sitting
in
the sauce.
See, that I don't understand at all. These are as simple as it is to heat up the Chef Boyardee. That's how easy it is to boil water and put macaroni in it.
Yeah, I'm with you. I don't get that either. But
so stop buying those.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. I don't understand how we went from an arena where Chef Boyardee had to change his name to Chef Boyardee. And then we got into an era, I think the dawn of the new era, was where a guy made up a name called Häagen-Dazs, which doesn't mean anything because it looks foreign,
right,
and has the umlaut over the thing. Come on.
I remember being 7 years old and being like, Mom, don't buy this anymore.
What, the Chef Boyardee?
Oh, yeah, SpaghettiOs, same thing. It was SpaghettiOs.
Your mom?
It was the 70s. You, like I said, everybody bought them.
Your mom is a great cook,
once.
Too. But it wasn't once. Your mom actually had that in the cabinet, did she?
No, I'm saying it was one of those things that you bought and you said, okay, that's gross, don't buy that anymore.
Yeah, you were smart.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Well, I was, luckily I had great food surrounding me all the time.
And I was Irish. Well, I hope you've enjoyed this hour as much as we have. I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are the Restaurant Guys on restaurantguysradio.com.